stray cat sitting on a fence. Ain't got enough dough to pay the rent. I'm flat broke, but I don't care. I strut right by with my tail in the air. Stray cat strut, I'm a
thief cat.
I'm a feeling Casanova. From a garbage can.
Selling more than 15 million albums, the Stray Cats are a music industry success story. In June 1980, James McDonald, known as Slim Jim Phantom, boarded a plane to the United Kingdom with his childhood friends and bandmates Brian Setzer and Lee Rocker. In less than a year, they went from being homeless, hungry, and living in punk rock squats to the toast of the London music scene. In the new book, A Stray Cat Struts, My Life as a Rockabilly Rebel by Slim Jim Phantom, he tells the story of their rise to stardom and a life spent in the upper echelon of rock and roll stardom. Slim Jim Phantom spearheaded the neo-rockabilly movement of the early 1980s. The Stray Cats' classic album, Built for Speed, went double platinum. The band had numerous hit singles, and their song Rock This Town is on the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame's list of the songs that shaped rock and roll. It is a great pleasure to welcome Slim Jim Phantom to the roundtable this morning. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Thanks, buddy. Pretty good.
Very nice. Well, it's very nice to have you on the program. So at what point in your life do you think, oh, I should write some of these stories down?
Everyone's always been, you know, saying it, you know, you should write a book, dude. And it's like, yeah, it's one of those easy, you know, and you should go pick the winning lottery numbers, too, while you're at it. It's hard. It's a lot to bite off. When I decided to write it, I did the kind of Reader's Digest backstories that a buddy of mine did a rock bio, a strippers and blow kind of bio. And he asked me to write a couple liner notes on the back. And I did that. I dashed off a few lines of rock journalism. And his agent, Dana Newman, who became my agent, she's kind of the star of the show for me. She said, oh, yeah, this is really good. You have a little bit of a way with it. Have you ever written? And I said, no. And although I had thought of it, I was pretty good in English in high school, and I've always read a lot, kind of fancied myself a little bit of a literate guy. As long as you don't do it, you can't be rejected kind of thing, you know, and you can go to your grave saying, well, I could have done it if I wanted to, but not. So anyway, she coaxed a story out of me, and I didn't know what to do, really, so I wrote a story about Lemmy. That was the first one I did, Lemmy from Motorhead. He was my good buddy, and it's just a story about he and me going to a club in London and playing the slot machines. And then having to pay the taxi driver on the way home with coins, pocketfuls of coins, right? And in between those two, you know, the beginning and the end, there's 25 pages of what London was like in 1981 and who else was at the club and where we drove past and who else we saw and the gig we went to before that. So I took the approach of telling like little stories and just in between the punchline and the first line, tell a story of a broader stroke of what life was like during that time that I wrote the story.
She
shopped it, and we got a couple of good offers for it, you know, and we decided St. Martin's, they were from New York, so I could relate to that, and so it was pretty much, again, a little haphazard and on my end.
You decided against the strippers and blow aspect of the book?
Well, yeah, a lot of guys have done that, and a lot of them are, like, better than me. They have better tales to tell with that than I do. We have a little bit of it, but I kind of wanted to take an approach that was a little bit more that I could own, that I could really, and the kind of cast of characters that I included and a few of the adventures that link it all together, I don't really know anyone else that could have brought together that same cast, so that's the route I decided to go.
As you mentioned, the early days of going to London, and I mentioned it in the introduction as well, what was it about London that allowed your musical career to take off?
Well, I think in a funny way, for the teenager there at the time, I think even now too, they're very identified by the music, more so than they are in the States, I think. It's very important there. I think like when they're young, they decide they usually pick if you're going to be a mod or a rockabilly or a teddy boy or a punk rocker or a post-punk modernist. You know, they like seem to be a little bit more tribal, the kids there. And we didn't know any of this. We had just kind of heard that we had met a few English people, I think, that come over. We met in New York, and they said, you guys would be really popular there. And someone had brought back one of the music mags, Melody Maker or one of those ones, and there was a picture of some teddy boys there who had gone to Brighton and had a fight with the mods, and we just thought the whole thing was very cool. And it was exactly around the time when we were starting to get the Sex Pistols record and the First Clash record, and the Pretenders had just, you know, like things were changing a little bit, and we were getting little whiffs of it. So we thought, wow, it's a great idea. They seem to be really cool over there. There's King's Road, this place where everyone gets dressed up and walks around, and everyone's a rock star, seemingly. So we just thought it would be a more open-minded, maybe kind of birds of a feather flock. So we flocked over there, you know, and then realized the reality of it all very quickly, that we didn't have any money and no connection and nowhere to call and nowhere to stay and nowhere to... So we had to pretty much fend for ourselves at that point.
But it ultimately worked, and you caught on.
Well, yeah, we were virtually homeless. We, you know, lived outdoors at the, you know, luckily it was a summer in London that didn't rain. Which we didn't know any about that, anything about that kind of stuff. We kind of maybe lucked out by when we went. It was June, I believe, and we crashed out with people that we met. We found a big punk rock mansion that had been taken over by squatters. It was right out of Sid and Nancy. People sleeping on the floor and sleeping bags and all that, all dressed up. And we were just old enough to get into X-rated theaters, and you could pay 50 pence and stay there for 24 hours. So we like would sleep where most grown boys were probably watching the screen. We were like asleep in the front row just because you could crash out and it was dark in there. So all that kind of stuff that I wouldn't really want to do now or that I wouldn't recommend to anybody. But so we kicked around the whole summer and into the fall, and we just knocked on doors and hung around parties and went to gigs that we could get in for free, and just really made our presence known on the tiny scene there. We finally got a couple of gigs, Fourth on the Bill at a pub going on at 5 in the afternoon. And when we were able to actually take control of our lives a little bit, what we can go and play for 20 minutes now, and maybe we can get something to eat from it, and maybe we can get a hotel for the night, we were very good at it. We had been playing in New York for about a year, five nights a week, four sets a night. So we were very good. And of course, we had a kind of a different look. We had an upright bass. We stood on top of the drums and played it. And then they heard Brian play, who was a virtuoso, excellent guitar player and front man. And we started playing these first couple of gigs at a pub. Oh, you guys are pretty good tonight. Yeah, we need someone next Tuesday at 4 in the afternoon to play the first set. And the people that we had met and who came to those early gigs were Lemmy, Joe Strummer, Chrissy Hine, who brought Ray Davies, who brought Pete Townsend came one time. You know, it started to get like that. Yep. And so it was kind of these guys who've been talking a lot and at all these parties who were slightly scruffy and kept saying they were the best band in the world, and they are actually really good. So again, the music journalist world there is pretty small and it's very London centric. So as soon as they heard us play, there was a bit of a story built into it that was perfect, that we were homeless, we were from New York, we were young, we had combined rockabilly music with, you know, the spirit of punk rock, and it was a built-in story. So word spread pretty quickly, and it led to some better gigs, and that led to a record deal.
You write early in the book about the time you spent with the Rolling Stones. You say you first saw them play live when you opened for them at the Fox Theater in Atlanta in 1981. How did you come to open for them?
Well, they had heard about us, and that's like a recurring theme in the book, is that this is really American music, what we do, and it's influenced by the original American rock and roll stars, Elvis Presley, of course, Carl Perkins, Jerry Lee Lewis, Chuck Berry, Little Richard, Buddy Holly, Johnny Burnett, and that's the real inspiration of this music. And it was also the inspiration for the Beatles and the Stones. You don't have the Beatles without Carl Perkins, and you don't have the Stones without Bo Diddley and Buddy Holly. And these guys loved this music. They love American rock and roll. And early on, when the word started to spread slightly about, you know, that we were doing these gigs in pubs, and Chrissy Hynde and Joe Strummer and Lemmy and Steve Jones and, you know, all of our kind of buddies back then were coming to the shows, Stones is still very hip and intuitive and well-informed guys, and they heard about this newest, hottest thing that's going on in London, and it happened to also be something that they loved themselves, so they wanted to check it out. And they all came to one of the early shows we did at the venue, Victoria Station, right in the middle of London. And it was a pretty rare occurrence, I think, even then, that all of those guys would be in the same place at the same time. And that wasn't one of their own shows or one of their own business meetings. Like, they all came and got a table, and we did the gig, and we did very well that night. And then afterwards, we were ushered to their table. They wanted to meet us. And the first thing that happens is Keith Richards stands up and, like, you know, knocks over some drinks and says in his kind of best American accent, Keith version, "Hey, man, all we did was sell your music back to you, man. That's what we did. We love, you know." And it's true. This, you know, the British Invasion were bands that were really influenced by the American original rock and rollers. And so those guys liked us, and we met with them quite a few times because they were interested in producing the record and it being on, they had a label back then, Rolling Stones Records, and they wanted to be on their label and they wanted to produce it. But after that initial night out, it was very hard to get those guys all in one room again, especially Mick and Keith. They have their own scenes going on. So we did the record with Dave Edmonds, who's another big part of the story. Fast forward a few months, and the Stones did their Tattoo You tour, 1981, and they asked us to be the opening act for parts of the tour in America. And again, it was a great opportunity, which we couldn't say no to, but our record hadn't been released in America yet. And even though we're American, that's the irony of all those first few albums and years, was that we were an American group, but we weren't released in America yet. So we had the chore of going out every night at the Enormo Dome in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, and Minneapolis, and all these kind of places, and winning over 30,000 people that had never heard of us before. And we still, this is pre-MTV, we still looked a little bit out of the ordinary at an arena rock show. And every night we managed to win over the Stones crowd. And had some adventures along the way. And on the nights off, we played in little bars. So there's a handful of shows out there that we did in very small places across the states before anyone had really heard it.
It's you, Lee Rocker, and Brian Setzer. You read about this a little bit in the book. But now you say that when you look at the group, I mean, how do you all get along? Because it's tough staying a group, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. It's the hardest thing that there is because, you know, especially when everyone has a life that starts to set in. And I think when you're younger, it's a bit, well, it's a little bit easier to keep that part of it in the beginning because that's all you had. The group was everything. You know, you didn't even think about what you would do that day besides whatever it was that was on tap to do with the band that day. You never had a choice. Well, maybe I'll do this, maybe I'll do that. Maybe I'll be with my kids, maybe I'll hang out with my wife, maybe I'll, the idea of doing anything that wasn't 100% centered around the band, you just never had that thought. That's what you did. And so when you get a little older, life enters into it. And, you know, good or bad, the guys from the Stray Cats, we've known each other since we've been literally, you know, 5, 7 years old. So you go through a lot of things together. The first time that you have a success, the first time you have not a success, the first time you get married, the first time you get divorced, the first time you have a record, the first time you have is all the common experiences with the same three people, you know? And for as good as that is, it's also bad, like, you know each other so well that you know what the other guy likes and doesn't like to such an extent that, you know, life takes over.
Yeah.
And personally, I'm the drummer. I get along with everybody. That's part of the job, you know.
You say that it puts you in the unenviable position of being the peacemaker, being between the two who don't really care for each other.
Yeah, that's pretty safe to say, I think, yeah. And that's there. That's got to be in their book, you know. I don't have a problem with anybody. I think especially now we should just embrace the legacy, play when we can. Because we do it every, you know, the last time was about 6 years ago, I think, 5 years ago. Every now and again we get it together, everyone's schedule. I mean, a lot of it's scheduling, too. Everyone's got other careers, kind of, you know. Both those guys make records and tour and do other stuff in life. So I think every now and again, you know, the schedule lines up. But the reason why we play has nothing to do with whether or not there's a desire for it, because I think it's bigger now than it ever was. It's really now, when we really started doing it, I think we invented a little bit of a part of the subculture. There's this whole hot rod tattoo, you know, rockabilly, roots rock and roll scene out there that didn't exist. I mean, if there was a tattoo convention and a hot rod show in Long Island in 1979, we might not have ever moved. We were really looking for, like, a few other people to hang out with who kind of knew what we were doing. And the rest of it happened after that, really. We were just trying to find some other cool cats who knew who Johnny Burnett was. Really that simple.
You write in the book, a lot of guys have sold more records and had more money, more girls, more drugs, but not with the same combination of varying adventures as the Stray Cats. Country guys stay with country guys, rock guys stay with rock guys, actors stay with actors. The Stray Cats, and I in particular, have straddled all these fences. How do you think you've been able to straddle those fences?
Well, I think, again, that's a little bit luck of the draw of what you chose, because unbeknownst to us at the time, because we were so young, we just found this music and this style and just loved it and dived in both feet first, was that rockabilly and the original American rock and roll is cool to everybody. Like I said, when we first went to England and then to London, every town, and then we found this all across Europe as well, not really so much in the States, but in Europe, every town has its, again, its rockabillies, its punk rockers, its mods, its ska guys, its metal people, you know, whatever it is that your little tribe is, rockabilly, and you know, and then the Stray Cats, because we did it upright, was accepted as cool by everybody. So, you know, the people I write about in the book are still people I'm friends with. You know, Lemmy, Steve Jones, Chrissy Hynde, seemingly all varying styles and genres of rock and people, but the Stray Cats were kind of a unifying thing. Like, everyone could like it. Like, if you're a punk rocker and you said you liked the Stray Cats, your friends wouldn't be get mad at you. Or if you were a Teddy Boy and you said, you know, like, we were accepted by all the different tribes. And then as you grow older, the same kind of thing, you know, I'm a nice guy. I like everybody. I'm still friends with all the people that are in the book. And I don't know of anyone else that can put, you know, Jerry Lee Lewis, Chrissy Hynde, George Harrison, Keith Richard, Lemmy, Britt Eklund, all into the one story with one kind of, and tie a bow around it. I'm the only one I know that could do that with that cast of characters.
You write about falling off the stage. That seems like something that really changed you.
Yeah, it was at a funny time. It was at Brixton Academy, London, I don't know, 7 years ago.
Yep.
And the Stray Cats had gotten back, one of the times we got back and started to do some touring and some, you know, we had made a film the previous year, I think, from a concert film that was really good. And the show was over. We had just played the gig and we were back in the dressing room, well, on the way back to the dressing room. And how a lot of rock and roll tours work is that, let's say there's 25 shows on a tour, the first 20 go to paying the travel expenses, the crew, the lighting, the sound, the trucks, the commissions to the agent and management, and then the last 5 shows, the band makes the money. You know, that's your gravy kind of thing. And we had done a very successful tour of Europe, and now we had like 5 shows left, which wouldn't have been the easy ones. There was London, there was Glasgow, there was Manchester, there was Dublin, which was good. I had my family go to meet me there and hang out in Dublin for a while. You know, it was the kind of easy, the gravy, and a few things went wrong at once. Someone from the front row tried to hand me something, which 99.999% of the times I'll never even look. I took my eye off what I was doing for a second. There's a slight curve in the stage at Brixton Academy, and my heel of my boot got caught in a crack of the old wooden floor, all at the same split second, you know? And I just took a tumble, and I fell straight down into the orchestra pit, which was probably 10 feet or so, and I put my hand down to brace my fall, and I broke my arm, and the whole tour just came to a screeching halt. I couldn't do anything. I went back to L.A., and in the dressing room waiting for me were my buddies, and there's a picture in the book. There's one last picture I did before I had to go to the hospital. It was Captain Sensible from The Damned, Glenn Matlock from the Sex Pistols, Mick Jones from The Clash, Charlie Harper from UK Subs, and myself. And I think it was the first time there was a Clash, a Sex Pistol, and a Damned in the same photograph. And it was in my dressing room. So again, it's the you know, the unifying quality that you know, luckily we have a little bit of. So I just had to fly straight back to L.A. The tour just ended. Everyone got paid except for us because it was the last five shows. And to their credit, those guys were always good about that part of it. It was just an accident. It really was just one of those things that happens. And I went home to L.A., went straight off the plane to an operation. Had my arm, you know, was powder, my wrist, and they rebuilt it, and I had a cast on for 10 weeks, and I got to sit on my couch and just think about life for 10 weeks. You know, I couldn't drive, I couldn't have a shower, I couldn't do anything. So having 10 weeks to sit in solitude and think is kind of a bad thing for most people. I think it's better to be busy and and not think about it too much, you know. But then I just, you know, reassessed life and said, I got to, you know, certain things have to change, and you know. And since then, it's proved harder than ever to gear up just the thing with the Stray Cats as well. You know, just to get everyone on the same page and the right offers and the right, you know, right schedules. So, yeah, that was one of those moments, for sure.
Well, the book is filled with great stories, and we didn't even get to Britt. We didn't even get to Clint Eastwood. But there's a lot of great stories in the book.
Oh yeah, Clint Eastwood. That's one of the best ones too.
Yeah,
I forgot about that one because I've been doing a lot of rock stations and stuff, and everyone wants to talk about Keith Richards and Lemmy, and then all the guys want to know about, you know, Britt Eklund and the Playmates and all that kind of stuff, and having a nightclub. And Clint's fallen by the wayside in my interview so far.
But
we could throw Clint Eastwood into the mix.
But he directed you.
Yes, I did a small part in a movie one time. It was with Forrest Whitaker, who's a good guy.
Yep.
And Clint Eastwood, and then I retired from the movies, and no one can say they've done one movie and acted their scenes with and was directed by two Oscar winners. So.
And it was Bird, and it was a great film.
Yeah, Charlie Parker story. Yeah. And, you know, there's a couple of funny stories that went along with it. But, yeah, Clint Eastwood really is that guy in real life. He is Dirty Harry.
Well, there are a lot of great stories. The book is A Stray Cat Struts, My Life as a Rockabilly Rebel. It is published by St. Martin's Press. Slim Jim Phantom, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure
to have you. Thanks for having me, man. I had a good time today.
Thanks very much. Thank you. Again, the name of the book, A Stray Cat Struts. It's published by Thomas Dunn Books. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC. Well, maybe when I late Saturday.